We're delighted to have Jonathan Mahler here. Our subject really is democracy in the world. It turns out to have a very specific application as we talk about the challenge.
That's part of the challenge, isn't it? That there's
is that a double entendre? The challenge?
No. it's an oblique reference, an overt reference. I think my impression is that everybody involved in this had a different view of what mattered in this. I mean, that's part of what makes this so complicated, because some people think it's about democracy, some think about it as the rule of law, some think of it as protecting us from the bad guys.
Right.
The bad guys, you know, a move is sort of a movable feast.
Right.
But it seems that complexity is a big part of what's involved in this.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah.
So how did you sort your way through that?
Must have been hard.
It was. I mean, I think you know, I really sort of let the characters guide me. I mean, I let the two lawyers, you know, in particular, who I haven't spoken about, but you know, one was this Navy JAG lawyer, Lieutenant Commander Charlie Swift, and
JAG being the judicial
judge advocate general. Yeah,
I never translate that correctly.
He was a Navy officer,
and it's important to say that having him in the Navy really mattered, because that has a whole different history of jurisprudence. Goes back 175, 200. George Washington starts this JAG
Corps, yeah.
And then it changes extremely gradually, because it's, after all, the Navy.
Right.
So you've got the military justice system within the civilian justice system.
Yeah, that's right.
And you've got a lawyer who's in the military and has been 20 years there.
But within is part of the question. I mean, it was not within. I mean, that was the argument, wasn't it? At least partially.
In terms of...
Within the civilian system, that the military, I mean, part of the challenge...
No, I just meant Charlie Swift was in the military.
Right.
The Lieutenant Commander Swift.
I take it all back.
And then you have a constitutional lawyer who's at Georgetown.
Yes.
So it's really, this is quite a stew you have here.
It is, yeah. And I mean, the two of them are a very unlikely pair. I mean,
in what way?
Well, you have, Swift was a you know, to begin with, he's graduated the Naval Academy, but actually sort of struggled through the Naval Academy and nearly failed out, nearly got kicked out for among other things, getting caught skinny dipping with a bunch of strippers.
This is a free spirit.
Yes.
These things happen at the Naval Academy, don't they?
Yes. And he was, he is a real kind of trial lawyer, he really found his calling as a defense lawyer and is just great in a courtroom. He's a great storyteller. He's great at bonding with his clients.
So he goes back into the military to practice this craft.
Exactly. And does this for about 10 years. And, you know, his job is basically to defend wayward servicemen of you know, cocaine possession or you know, something like that, sexual harassment, whatever. And he's sort of, you know, plucked from that kind of obscurity and by the Pentagon and told that he's going to represent Osama bin Laden's driver in these historic military tribunals. So he, you know, he's very much someone who was, you know, thrust into the center of a historic moment.
But he did have an option, didn't he? I
mean, he could have refused. He could have said
to...
no. He certainly could have said no, and he volunteered for the duty. Yeah,
but that's one of the interesting things to me about watching the law work its way through this, particularly a case like this, is the individuals who have to make serious, substantive decisions about what they care about.
That's right.
And this was not a good career move.
Well, his superior, I guess you call it in the military, G-U-N-N,
Colonel Gunn.
Colonel Gunn. Thinks long and hard and has to sleep on it through sleepless nights, as it were.
Yeah.
So none of this is easy.
No, right. For Gunn, it was an even more, in many ways, it was a more complicated question, because, you know, Colonel Gunn, who was the first chief of the defense team for these Guantanamo detainees, he was African-American. He was a graduate of Harvard Law School and of the Air Force Academy, and he was widely respected and admired, and was considered to be a strong candidate to make general and to be the very possibly the first African American top JAG in the Air Force. So for him it was really, you know, for Charlie Swift, you know, he had a military career ahead of him, or he seemed to, but it wasn't quite the same calculus. He was, even within the JAG Corps at the time, I mean, he was something of a rebel. I'm not suggesting that it wasn't, career suicide and a major sacrifice for him as well.
And everybody knew it.
Oh yeah, everyone knew. But, I mean, he was one of a very, very small handful of people who were willing to do this. Yeah.
And part of it is, as you describe it, is his experience in being a good defense lawyer.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Because he trained himself, learned and trained himself to do whatever was necessary within the law to get his clients acquitted.
That's right.
And
that was his
perspective, not his career.
That's right.
He started first with justice.
That's right.
And then the career was secondary.
And
to that.
And
Gunn makes that same decision.
That's right. And here for Swift, the two you had almost sort of a confluence of two forces. You had his duty, his obligation as a lawyer to provide the most vigorous defense that he could for his client, and you had his duty as an officer to uphold the Constitution, which he felt that his commander in chief had violated. So he was, operating really on these two principles.
And by commander in chief, unambiguously, we're talking about the president.
We're not talking about his executive exo
or whatever.
The president of the United States, right. His commander in chief. Yeah.
And it's almost titanic forces here. And there's a David and Goliath sense.
Very much.
At one point, you say that I think you're quoting Swift saying that he's looking down the gun directly at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Yeah.
This is this little guy in the Navy who is defying. And as he says to a bunch of kids from Wisconsin when it all, later in the story, in other parts of the world, when you defy your commander, it's called a coup.
Exactly.
So all of this is titanic. This is huge.
And is he going to be able to persuade judges to even if he's willing to sort of hang himself out to dry, basically, is he going to be able to persuade judges to essentially do the same thing, to rule against the President of the United States during a time of war? After the most horrendous attack on the United States, on American soil, in the country's history.
And the wound is still open.
Absolutely. Yeah. And
this is still 2001.
That's right. And part of it was one of the things that Swift, I think, recognized early on was that, the only way that the consensus view among the American public was so against him to begin with. I mean, who cared about the rights of accused terrorists in the aftermath of 9/11? No one.
Well,
he knew,
almost no one.
Okay,
very few people. It was not popular.
And he was, he recognized that for him to really kind of turn the tide and to have a shot at winning, he needed to kind of get out there and tell people, look, this isn't right. This tribunal system is illegal, unconstitutional. This is an abuse of executive power. It's a violation of American principles to not give someone a fair trial, to not give him the rights that he's entitled to.
Paul mentioned 2001, and this all happened after 9/11, and I found myself going back, pardon me, to 1215.
Why did you do that, Bill?
It was a number that just sort of popped into my head.
Because
we're still talking about, we're still arguing about the principles behind Magna Carta.
That's right, yeah.
That the king, executive, whoever, the chief executive, and whatever the name we apply, is not above the law.
That's right. This is from the very beginning. This was when they first filed this lawsuit, which alleged that these military tribunals were unlawful, that the president had essentially violated the law, had violated the separation of powers principles, among other things, was violating this man Hamdan's Geneva Convention rights. When they first filed this lawsuit, the Bush administration's position was that no lawsuit from Guantanamo Bay could even be heard, that these detainees had no right to the U.S. courts.
Which is why they put them there.
That's right. That's exactly right. That's why they created Guantanamo Bay. That's why they decided to send them to Guantanamo Bay. And that it was what the administration had done was effectively suspend the right of habeas corpus, something that had been around since 1215. Yeah.
I think it's important for you to say explicitly what the Bush administration did in the context of
could be before we say what the Bush this notion of habeas corpus.
Okay, all right. Let's do habeas corpus when we come back, so I don't have to interrupt it. Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, Jonathan Mahler, all three of us are talking about some of the most important subjects in the world, and we'll continue to do so in a moment when we come back.